Welcome to session number 352, The Male Faces of Mormonism, To Beard or Not To Beard. And our speaker today, who does have some facial hair, I'm glad to see, is Alan Eastman, who's a gentleman who did grow up in Salt Lake City, but lived in Oklahoma for many years, and now he's back in Salt Lake City. He's a chemist by vocation, a PhD, but he's also a musician by application. You may recognize him as the main piano player for Sunstone Symposium for the last 4 years. He and his wife have 9 children between them. Any bearded?
One, sometimes two.
I assume they're both males? Okay. And so we'll go until 3:15 and... Oh, and we do have a respondent. This is. Okay, our respondent has arrived, Mary Ellen Robertson. And Mary Ellen has an MA in Women's Study and Religion from the Claremont College School. And she's been a lifelong studier of men and their curious ways. She's currently working as the Effort Reporting Specialist in the Research Administration Office at the University of Texas, an American, and she writes a weekly online column called Valley Girl for the local newspaper. So, welcome.
Thanks. Actually, I think that's the Rio Grande Valley, not the valley you're thinking of, right? Anyway. This paper discusses the male faces of humanity over the years, especially the attitudes displayed in Mormonism towards male facial hair. We'll discuss beards in their historical context and civilization at large, and then narrow our focus of that to the changes in feelings about facial hair since Joseph Smith's time. It's pretty clear Mormonism has followed generally Western society at large with respect to facial hair. But certain peculiarities of the... Am I not close enough? Okay. Certain peculiarities... there are several ways to get close to this thing, I guess. Anyway, several peculiarities about LDS theology and actually Mormon culture have kept Mormon response a few years behind the rest of society. Moreover, the worldwide public image of Mormons has been molded by the faces we present, and the hair that covers and reveals those faces. Incidentally, facial hair doesn't seem to have been much of an issue in parts of the Mormon world outside the LDS Church. So most of the discussion says nothing about the Community of Christ or other non-LDS Mormon groups. Actually, talking to Bill Russell the other day, he said that there has never been much of a discussion in the Community of Christ about beards or mustaches or any sort of facial hair. He said basically we just sort of go with the flow. So we won't discuss them at all. We'll also concentrate mostly on the United States, since a lot of the controversy was before the huge explosion in LDS population outside the continental United States in the last couple of decades of the 20th century. Those of us who have facial hair like to associate our fuzziness with masculinity, individuality, maybe a little bit of intellectual conceit, maybe a little intellectual attainment, a liberal outlook on life, and all sorts of other good things. On the other hand, maybe wearing facial hair is seen as a sign of rebellion, eccentricity, or just general slovenliness. Where does the truth lie, and especially how does this relate to Mormon culture and religion? Let's start with the ancient and classical world. The ancient Egyptians associated facial hair with mourning, with the exception of the pencil-thin mustache or goatee. They generally found beards unattractive. One exception, of course, was the pharaoh, who wore a ceremonial and usually bald beard as a symbol of authority. Even the female pharaohs, like Hatshepsut here, wore a false beard to buttress their claim to the throne. So, this is one case where ladies were actually encouraged to grow facial hair. Nations further east in Egypt usually treated their beards with great care and veneration. The punishment for licentiousness or adultery was to have the beard of the offender publicly shaved off. Some civilizations had such a terror for the beard that you could actually pledge it as security for payment of debt. The fondness for beards got them in trouble occasionally when fighting in Greece. Alexander the Great, for example, advised his troops to cut off their own beards because there's not a better handle in close combat than your enemy's beard, holding by the beard in the back. Despite that, the Greeks usually wore beards. An old Greek saying goes, there are two kinds of people in this world that go around beardless, boys and women, and I'm not either one. Despite that, shaving seems to have been unknown to the Romans during their early history. A bearded man was the proverbial expression for a man of virtue and integrity. And that changed after Scipio Africanus, one of the first Romans to shave. After that, being clean shaven became a sign of being Roman. Incidentally, the Romans scraped their beard hair off with a sharpened seashell or had it plucked out one hair at a time. Neither one of them sounds like a great deal of fun, but the Romans had slaves to do that kind of stuff. And speaking of that, the Roman slaves were not allowed to pull their hair, shave their beards, thus distinguishing themselves from their clean cut masters. The Emperor Hadrian was the first Roman emperor to grow a beard in admiration and imitation of Greek culture. From that time on, beards had once again become common in Rome. Rome's opponents were often bearded. In one Germanic tribe, a young man wasn't allowed to shave or cut his hair until he had slain an enemy. I don't know, but Caesar seemed to always fight lots of bearded Germans. I don't know how many enemies were killed. The Lombards were originally known as the Longobards, which translates long beards. When Otho the Great was one of their kings, he used to speak at anything serious and swore by his beard, which covered his whole chest. In the Middle Ages, clergymen were usually clean-shaven, which indicated their celibacy. During the Protestant Reformation, however, when a priest became convinced of the new religion, he let his beard grow as a signal. That would show he rejected the doctrines of the church and probably its stance on celibacy as well. The longer the beard, the more striking the statement. So some of them let their beards grow quite long. They were, however, handy. It's written that French Protestant Admiral Gaspard de Coligny kept his ivory toothpaste tucked away in his beard, but use it in time. Now, by Shakespeare's time, beards were considered an art mark of manliness. Listen to Beatrice and wants to do about nothing, or much do about nothing. What should I do with him? Dressing in my apparel and making my way in gentlewoman? He that hath a beard is more than a youth, and he that hath no beard is less than a man. And he that is more than a youth is not for me, and he that is less than a man, I'm not for him. In urban circles in 17th in Europe and Western Europe and the Americas, beards again became out of fashion after this in the early 17th century, to such an extent that in 1698, Hugh the Great levied a tax on beards in order to bring Russian society more in line with the West. Beards returned strongly to fashion after the Napoleonic era. For example, we have Napoleon III, Charles Dickens, Brahms, Alexander III of Russia. If you didn't have a beard, you were nobody. In the 18th and 19th century, beards were rare in the United States. Again, fashion changes. But elsewhere, they've become prevalent by the middle of the 19th century, as you can see. Before Lincoln, no president had a beard. From Lincoln until McKinley, the Civil War was when the beard sprouted. Between Lincoln and McKinley, every president except Andrew Johnson, and he wasn't very popular, had either a beard or a mustache. The beard's loss of popularity since the 19th century has shown that since that golden age, no president has worn a full beard since Benjamin Harrison, and no president has worn any facial hair at all except William Howard Taft. Well, beards really stopped appearing during World War I, perhaps because they were no longer allowed in the military. There are several theories as to why that happened. One that's gained currency is because the guys had to wear gas masks they had to shave, because I can cite from personal experience working in a refinery that masks do not fit over your beard very well. They let in things that you just do not have in. So the other thing is that King Gillette and his Gillette Safety Razor Company really got popular, and it became easy and cheap to shave at home. Clean shaven faces were the only acceptable style for decades after this. From the 20s to the early 60s, the few men in the United States who wore beards were either Olds, they're Central Europeans, or they're academics, or they're part of the counterculture, the beatniks. Beards were a fringe phenomenon, so to speak. Beards and long hair were reintroduced to the mainstream of the society in Western Europe and America during the 60s. Popular rock and folk musicians like the Beatles and Barry White and Peter Paul and Mary, as you recall, wore beards. Facial hair became a political statement rather than a fashion. Every teenage boy who wanted to show his rebellion and he just wanted to look cool grew up to do a beard. In the early 90s, the stubble beard got a huge emphasis from the TV show Miami Vice. Well, from the 1990s onward, the perceived linkage between countercultural behavior and facial hair is even a lot. Fashion in beards is generally trended towards either a goatee, a Van Dyke, or a close to the top, full beard undercut on the throat. It's not unusual these days to see corporate executives in modern America with full beard. Let's talk about beards and religion. The Sikhs consider a full beard to be an integral part of the human body as it was created by God, and believe that it should be preserved and maintained and respected as such. The Bible says in Leviticus that you shall not round the corners of your beards, neither shall thou mar the corners of your beard. Well, Talmudic rabbis understood this to mean that a blade against the skin mars the beard. So Orthodox Jews do not shave. On the other hand, some of them use scissors and some of them use razors, because in that case it isn't blade against the skin, it's blade against another blade or blade against the wood. And so there's a lot of debate there. Many Muslims wear beards too. Some do so because Muhammad wore a beard. Some do so because Muhammad was quoted by a commentator saying, "Do the opposite of what the pagans do. Keep your beards and cut your mustache." Placed in historical context, it was used as a way to distinguish themselves from surrounding non-Muslims. Some fundamentalist Muslims, like certain terror groups we all know about, believe in wearing beards because it's considered virtuous. And though not strictly Muslim, there's an old Arab saying that says, "A man without a mustache is like a cat without a tail." Nice cats are not found on the Arabian Peninsula, needless to say. In Eastern Christianity, beards are often worn by members of the priesthood, and are sometimes been required for all believers. Amish and Hutterite men shave until they're married, and then grow a beard and never live out on thereafter. We'll talk about you a little bit. In general, early Christians considered beards to be the mark of man. Men who didn't have beards were regarded as either immature or effeminate. Consider the quotations from St. Clement of Alexandria. "The hair of the chin shows you to be a man. How womanly it is for one who is a man to comb himself and shave himself with a razor for the sake of fine effect, and to arrange his hair at the mirror, shave his cheeks, pluck hairs out of him, and smooth them. For God wished women to be smooth and rejoice in their locks alone, growing spontaneously as a horse in his mane. But he adorned man like the lions with a beard, and endowed him as an attribute of manhood with a hairy chest, a sign of strength and noble." The feminist thing that my wife mentioned earlier would not appreciate that quote as much as some do. "This then is the mark of a man, by this the beard. By this he seemed to be a man, it's holy to the knee. It's the token of superior nature. It's therefore unholy to this great symbol of manhood, hairiness." Now finally, let's come to beards in LDS history. That history, like most histories, filled with really interesting stories. In some quarters, Mormons are always thought of as being bearded. For example, a survey conducted in 1990 revealed that a significant number of Italians believe that contemporary Mormons practice polygamy, wear old-fashioned clothing, dress in black, and that Mormon men have long beards while women coat their hair with heads of locks. In fact, most of the Romance language versions of the film Witness said in Amish country translated the word Amish as Mormon. You can imagine how the Church Missionary Committee was probably more than a tad upset about that one. I understand those translations have now been corrected, but that's how they originally came out. Well, where did that idea come from? Well, we know from early church records Joseph Smith was basically clean shaven, except when he went several days clean shaves, and that's obvious. Also obvious from history, he didn't mind letting that happen either. He looked kind of grubby. Early pictures of other church officials, like Brigham Young, John Taylor, Orson Pratt, Wilford Woodruff, and so on, show that they were also beardless in the Nauvoo period. Martin Harris was an exception, but nobody seemed to care one way or another because he was considered maybe a little bit old-fashioned to have kept his beard. And it was a funny one like now like this. Yep, that's true. That's the way Martin Harris wore it. Anyway, once most of the church relocated to Salt Lake, we see pictures of most male church members with beards, especially about the time of the Civil War, when the rest of the country also acquired beards. Clearly, the church's de facto style of facial hair simply matched that of the nation from which they were desperately trying to distinguish themselves at the time. Beards were such a normal part of life that there was actually very little discussion about them in the church. I was able to find a couple statements, though. Junius Wells was the editor of a magazine called The Contributor. He said in the magazine's July 1883 issue that men have beards because they need them, and it's wicked to cut them off. No growth or part of the body is superfluous. Orson Pratt, speaking in 1874, said, "When therefore we read in the Book of Mormon that every hair of the head shall be restored, I don't expect that the whole of the matter that's been incorporated in the hair of the beard will be restored, but I look for enough of it to make one appear comely with hairs and ornaments." He clearly expected to be bearded in the resurrection and thought beards made him look comely. Fortunately, my wife agrees with him on that. Joseph E. Robinson, speaking at General Conference in April 1912, quoted Pliny the Younger on the physical appearance of the Savior, talking about his beard. On the whole, that quotation is known to be spurious, and Pliny never actually mentioned the Savior, but it does kind of illustrate what members of the church thought about it. Around the turn of the 20th century, D.H. Roberts wrote a little pamphlet called Tracting, On Tracting for Missionaries to the Church. He said it's of the highest importance that one make a good impression on those men in tracking. Elders should be suitable and clad in dark clothing, neatly pressed and brushed, clean linen underwear, daily shave, or if you're the computer technician. Heber J. Grant showed up in England in 1903 to replace Francis M. Lyon. By the way, here's some beards in the early church, compliments of dialogue, which had that as the insert of one of the early issues. Francis M. Lyman here showed up in England, was replaced by Heber J. Grant as president of the European mission. A day or two after Lyman, he asked all his missionaries to grow beards, by the way, because he thought they would make his missionaries look more distinguished than on the church. Hugh J. Grant was approached by an elder who had flaming red hair and a kind of a scraggly little red beard, and the elder asked him to shave it off. And Elder Grant said, "Well, yeah, I think you better shave it off before that red stuff does the fire." In those days, some men in the church were anxious to cut off their beards, while some men today are really anxious to grow them. As the 20th century really got rolling, beards lost their popularity in the United States between missionary service and Gillette. In the church, there seemed to be a real difference between younger men, who were virtually all clean shaven, and older men, including many general authorities of the church, who still wore their beards. We can look, for example, at Heber J. Grant and George Albert Smith, who presided over a church of nearly completely clean-shaven men. Nobody seemed to care one way or another whether you had a beard until the 60s. Now, two major events determining the church's approach, to beer is happening in the 60s. The first was the hippie movement, which conflated long hair, drug use, highly visible and vehement opposition to social norms. Beers were grown less often for personal adornment than as a political statement. The second major event was the reign, and I use that word on purpose, the reign of Ernest Wilkinson as president of BYU. Much of the material that I'm going to use about BYU comes from the dialogue article by Brian Waterman. Wonderful. Wilkinson's expressed concerns in those of the BYU Board of Trustees, which, as you probably know, are composed of most of the Council of 12 of the church, where the BYU students exhibit the highest and best levels of, quote, student conduct. During the 60s, with increasing frequency, student conduct was conflated in many students' and administrators' minds with dress and grooming standards. Actual behavior was less important than what you look like. The most widely debated dress and grooming topic in the fall of 68 regarded beards on men, which Wilkinson identified squarely with the countercultural element on other campuses and with the anti-Vietnam War movement, behavior of which he was very excited about. In August, Wilkinson had written a letter to presidents to the parents of the incoming freshmen that said, "While there can be no objection to a properly trimmed mustache, and there is certainly nothing wrong with wearing beard," he wrote, "we would prefer our men to be clean shaven and keep their hair cut. We're living in an age," he added, "when shaving is so convenient there's no need to imitate our grandfather's terrible foliage." Well, noting that the school the previous year had gotten some criticism for the appearance of bearded students, he said, "At this institution we must resist even the appearance not only of evil, but also of the emulation of undesirable contemporary characters. We suggest that being clean-shaven and having your hair properly cut is not too great a price for you to pay to further the reputation of this student body." Well, in his only address to students, Wilkinson repeated the advice. The Associated Press had misreported Wilkinson's letter to parents, an outright ban on beards. So there was all kinds of fun that week. Wary of the bad press that such a story was going to generate, the Board of Trustees very quickly authorized the press release to say that Wilkinson's advice was not binding and that medium trim beards were permissible. However, at the same meeting of the board, despite the press release, Wilkinson received instructions from church leaders to continue his campaign to eliminate mini skirts and encourage male students to remain clean shaven and keep their hair short. Well, the clarifications that beards really weren't forbidden, and that Wilkinson's attempt to discourage them from advisory only freed students to wear beards, which they did. A few days after that, there was a front page picture in the BYU Daily Universe of three bearded professors. Wilkinson went ballistic and instructed them to shave if they wanted to keep their jobs. It also became noted that bearded students were being called into the administration office of university standards and strongly encouraged to shave. Well, in summer of 69, Wilkinson wrote in his annual letter to parents that the appearance of, quote, "the appearance of even one person on our campus who deviates from our standards of dress and appearance impairs our reputation." Just as missionaries weren't allowed to wear long hair or beards, he wrote, "BYU students as models of Mormonism to the entire world have the obligation to represent the church in the most favorable manner." Well, when students arrived to register in September of that year, they were greeted by a headline in the Daily Universe reminding them of that, that the regulations had tightened once again. What some of them were not expecting is that the administration had commissioned, quote, spotters, who scanned registration lines for the presence of beards or long hair on male students or high hems on the skirts of women trying to register the classes. The Associated Press reported that scores of students ran afoul of the guidelines and the violators were interviewed before being allowed. not to register. The associate dean, the assistant dean of students, told the Associated Press, all but one of the many students we interviewed agreed to re-examine their personal commitments. A friend of mine, and I'll call him Jim because I wasn't able to get hold of him and talk about the story, has a really great voice. As a pianist, I accompanied him for a long time. Jim actually served as a soloist in the Tabernacle Choir many times. And he had graduated from the University of Utah with a master's degree in musical theater. And he was so good, in fact, that BYU called him and said, "Can you come and give a few classes?" And he said, "You bet, I'd love to." Well, he gets down to BYU and decides, "Gee, I can take classes, additional classes, really cheap at a professor's discount." So he decided to take a couple of classes. He's standing in line to register. Remember, this is before computer registration. And all of a sudden, he feels people grabbing each of his elbows. And he looks, and there are two great big guys who turn to him and say, "You're under standards arrest." Well, he turned to them and said the first thing he could think of, which was, "But I'm a soloist in the Tabernacle Choir." It turned out his sideburns were about a quarter inch too long, even though he'd actually shaved before he went down there. With enforcement like that, it's easy to believe that the program got the desired results. By October, according to the minutes of the Dress Standards Committee, there were reportedly only two beards on the entire campus of BYU. One was a Sikh, and the other guy had a skin problem that did not let him shave. It wasn't just students who ran afoul of Uncle Ernie's prescriptions of facial hair. Even BYU's first president had a problem. BYU had lots of problems. This is Carl Mazur as he really looked. However, they wanted to put a picture on a BYU student directory. And so they brought in an artist to airbrush out the beard. Anyway, BYU had all kinds of problems. Well, as went BYU, so went the church as a whole. From the 60s nearly today to today, men wearing beards have been assumed by many LDS church leaders to be somehow subversive, rebellious, and in general not particularly spiritual. The reason usually given for this informal policy, akin to Elder Packer's unwritten rules, is that members of the church should look, quote, wholesome, that is, clean-shaven, preferably in a white shirt and dark suit, as opposed to the scruffy, informal, left-wing, counterculture, bearded hippies of the 60s. The look is very much the successful 1950s business man. Consider this from a talk by Elder Marvin J. Ashton in the 1970 General Conference. Generally, the cover or jacket of a book is designed to sell what's inside. We will not have to die to be judged by the cover of the Book of Life. For those who would say it's what you really are inside that counts, not the length of the hair or whether you wear a beard, I would say, if this is true, and I agree it is, why run the risk of looking like something you're not? Or this from a talk of Spencer Billy Kimball in the MIA conference of May 65. Young men should keep their faces shaved, their hair combed, and their haircuts conservative, and nails clean. There may be nothing wrong with the person who wears a beard, but this is opening his book to the real world to read. And employers and other thoughtful people may bypass the eccentric and the extremist in his distortion and abnormalities to find those who are stylish in moderation and who are dignified, which is an indication of depth and width and strength. Now, the tendency to look at beards as somehow evil or at the very least unspiritual extends to virtually all parts of the church. For example, even though the film shown during the temple endowment ceremony represents time periods when wearing beards was quite normal, it's been reported that President Harold Reagan's discomfort with the long hair and beards of participants in one of the early versions of the movie resulted in a whole new movie without beards and long hair. That was produced at BYU in the middle of the 70s. Some feel that intellectuals are, as a group, deadly enemies of the church. Certainly, the association appears with a certain degree of intellectual attainment or conceit hasn't helped accept these facial hairs of those holding church positions. There are lots of stories about bearded men who are asked to shave in order to present that desired wholesome appearance. I have a good friend who was a state president in Southern California. He wore them and still wears a full beard trimmed nicely. At one point, the visiting general authority of the state conference was an apostle sometimes known as he who must not be named as he. My friend was released as state president 3 weeks after that conference visit, some years before the end of the normal tenure for state presidents in the church. Unfortunately, there's a tendency among some church leaders at all levels to adopt the two handfuls of fertilizer theory. If a little bit is good, a lot is a lot better. Whoops, I don't want this one yet. If one handful of fertilizer is good, two handfuls is better, even what can sometimes kill a plant. They assume that any time that a general authority expresses a personal preference or makes a casual remark about something, that must be binding on the whole church in its most extreme manifestation immediately and forevermore. As a musician, I ran into this attitude in conjunction with hymns and church meetings. This has also happened with respect to facial hair. In a chat room I read, one man explained that he was state mission president and developed a skin condition that when he shaved, his whole face would bleed. And being faithful and responsive to his priesthood leaders, he stopped talking to state presidents to see if he could work something out. Eventually, he agreed to shave and bleed twice a week so that he could be clean shaven at state meetings and on Sundays. The problem was, he looked ratty in between, and that was affecting his professional life. So he grew a beard in order to make sure it was neat, took it to the barber once a week, and had it trimmed. After a few months, the state president asked for an interview and wanted to know why the guy no longer shaved. He said, I'm really sorry to see you grow a beard. After listening to the reasons why the beard was there, the state president said, gee, I'm sad. And you're going to have to leave your position. Another reason is he said, I'm sorry about your attitude, but I'm just going to have to release you from your position. Anyway, there's another reason frequently given why men in the church need to be clean shaven. One Salt Lake State president, for example, while acknowledging that facial hair doesn't affect temple worthiness, asked leaders, especially leaders of youth in his state, to be clean shaven. And the reason was as follows. Every member is a missionary. And since missionaries are required to be clean shaven, every man in the church should be clean shaven. This leads to some very interesting corollaries, like, since every member is a missionary, and because missionaries are required to be single, every man in the church should be unmarried. Since every member is a missionary, and full-time missionaries do not hold outside jobs, every member in the church should be unemployed. Similarly, every man in the church should wear a name tag, and every man in the church should be 19 or older. Now, what do we do about beards? Well, the current BYU Honor Code, now that President Wilkinson is long gone, sometimes lamented, says if mustaches are worn, they should be neatly trimmed and should not extend beyond or below the corners of the mouth. By the way, that airbrush version of Carl Mazur is now quite illegal by the way you are. Mustache extended beyond the corner of your mouth. Men are expected to be clean shaven and beards are not acceptable. That, however, is fortunately not applicable to the church as a whole. The most recent semi-official statement was from the I Have a Question column of the Ensign in February 1993. David King, former U.S. representative in Utah, and then president of the Washington, D.C. Temple, said church leaders, recognizing that fashions go in cycles, are sensitive to the rich cultural diversity within the church. For example, they've recently held that clean, neatly trimmed managed beards and long hair for men, as well as certain other fashions, are acceptable for the temple, presumably anything else in the church, providing they are not inherently offensive or vulgar, whatever that means. In the tropics, certain attire that in the northern climes may be considered extreme is not only acceptable but mandatory. Proper allowances must be made for these differences. In other words, go with the flow. As we enter the 21st century, people of middle age and younger generally see wearing of a beard as an individual preference, with no particular political statement implied. Though scraggly, unkempt facial hair still denotes for most people either a rebel or a wino, men who keep their facial hair clean and neat are generally acceptable in any part of society, with the exception of certain parts of the LDS Church. Why is this? Well, nobody really knows, but my opinion is that because the upper leadership of the church is predominantly of the generation formed in the 50s, the church's idea of respectful, righteous appearance will continue to follow the model of the 1950s business map. As those leaders leave us, and as more and more men in U.S. society at large demonstrate that wearing the beard is not necessarily a symbol of antisocial revolt or spiritual decay, beards will become more accepted in Mormonism until it won't really matter if you know one or not. We can expect a growing realization that the amount of hair on the face doesn't correlate very well with internal spirituality. 100 years ago, LDS authorities were as vigorously discouraging men from shaving their beards off their beards as they have been recently to encourage men to cut them off. Interestingly, even though the standard of approved grooming has shifted diametrically, the reason for sanctioning either beards or lack thereof has remained basically the same. The church, whether it wants to admit it or not, has unconsciously followed the general style of society at large, especially the styles current in the United States. In the meantime, we who insist on wearing beards, happily piercing, we console ourselves that if our beards are the only reason people can find to criticize us, we're doing very well indeed. Incidentally, you need to know that that's a very prophetic beard. I borrowed that from a portrait of Joseph F. Smith.
My slideshow is not as extensive. I just have one image that I could throw up here. What does a beardless woman, a feminist no less, have to say about facial hair on Mormon men, or men in general? I toyed with the idea of wearing a fake beard today to lend an air of authority to my remarks, but I think the rogue chin hairs that I'm sporting as I age will have to suffice. Come up close enough to see them happen. So, it says 1,000 words, doesn't it? This is the courtesy of an artist friend of mine who has an irreverent website and sells merchandise like this postcard and magnets. Jesus Shaves was the inaugural image, and after that she's branched out to what would cheeses do with an array of brie and cheddar, and then another one with an image of a water bug with the caption saying, "The bugs that walk on water, are they worshipped by the other bugs?" So I credit her for providing my image today. One thing that occurred to me as I was reading through Alan's paper and listening today was that it's interesting to find an arena where men are being judged, and the hairy ones found wanting based on their appearance. I think it's something that women are unfortunately way too familiar with, where their appearance is what is the most important thing about men. And I'm a little curious to hear about the different experiences of men who have that, who have run into problems or attitudes about what they have growing or not growing out of their chins and cheeks. I thought Alan's walkthrough of history was pretty fascinating. Traips through facial hair in the Western world and beyond, and showing the different significations that facial hair had over time. The Greeks and Romans kind of going back and forth between shaving and not shaving, and things like that reminded me of the Dr. Seuss story of the star-bellied sneeches, that as soon as one group had the stars on their bellies, the other group rushed to apply them, and then the ones who didn't have them wanted them, and the ones who had them didn't want them. So, this is, an endless cycle of wanting to differentiate themselves and how that wrapped up. So it was interesting to see the play between shaving, not shaving, and the reasons for that. I grew up with a father who sported facial hair most of my life because he didn't like shaving, and he was pretty vocal about that. And so I didn't know what his face looked like except in the pictures. And it turns out that I've married someone who I've only seen clean shaven in pictures. He's sporting a goatee, so I definitely have an affinity for it. Just remember the child running up and, getting daddy kisses and having his sisters tickle me and stuff. I think that using facial hair or other outward characteristics as the measure of a person is frequently problematic. I mentioned a little earlier. Those without the genetic wherewithal to grow a beard or facial hair are at a perpetual disadvantage. And the changing fashions and styles always end up leaving someone behind, regardless. I also had a front row seat for the institutional and social discomfort with facial hair on male faculty and students at BYU. I was there in 1986 with the airbrush cover, director cover of Carl Mazur's Beardless. And it was amazing how that hit the AP wires and the story just grew exponentially. And it kind of made you wonder, why make the fuss bigger by doing something like airbrushing off the beard? This just didn't really make sense to me. Also, at that time, I don't know if this is the first time that this is instituted or not at BYU, but if you had a compelling reason that you couldn't shave a dermatological issue or something else, you could get a beard card where you could get permission from the physician saying, you know, this individual cannot shave for a medical reason, and then you could sport facial hair on campus. And again, they didn't want, you know, beards down to people's knees, but, you know, regulated and trimmed facial hair was appropriate. But if you were ever asked, you had to present your beard card as proof that it was okay for you to have whatever was growing on your face.
It's my understanding that nothing in the registration package they gave the students indicated that a beard card was even available. You had to go into the administration office and specifically ask for it. But it wasn't noted publicly that such things were available.
Yeah, and one thing that the off-campus student newspaper kindly did for everyone who wasn't aware was they published a facsimile of a beard card in one of their issues so that anyone who really wanted a beard card could have one. You have a comment?
Because it's now you really know that one of the things that we have to do is to have a card.
The comment was that there are now instructions on the BYU website regarding how to procure, or the honor code website at BYU, on how to procure a beard card voucher if you need one. And that gets to my last point. The conflation of facial hair with honor and morality is another thing that I find really problematic, and in this way I would like to see the church's attitude catch up to the world around us, wherein facial hair is merely a matter of choice, preference, or fashion. It's not a moral issue. The presence or absence of facial hair does not telegraph the absence or presence of personal righteousness or integrity. And rather than go into all these contortions to airbrush, erase, or distance ourselves from the glorious beards of the past that are part of our church history, I would like to see us perhaps embrace facial hair for what it is, and not overlay all these moral implications over the top of it. And I think it would be really helpful for us to kind of unwind on this point. And if we look to the pictures of Christ that come out of a church-sanctioned, appropriate library art and things that you hang on your wall at home, Jesus has a beard in all of those, and if it's good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me.
I guess it's just a question and answer. If you use this mic, it'll get on the recording. That's what 3:15.
One of the questions I have, Alan, is from my little amount of research, King Gillette really had a lot to do with it in an economic sense. If he had to come up with an advertising campaign to convince all these bearded men to start shaving, and that's where a lot of this clean-shaven, honest, virtuous... Is that accurate?
Yes, that actually is accurate. Many of the advertising campaigns early on showed very curvy, good-looking women huddling up to a man who was freshly clean-shaven with his Gillette blades, stroking his smooth cheek. And it was the if you study advertising in a marketing class at university, I understand that Gillette's early advertisements are cited as a model and maybe the first modern advertising campaign. I actually looked up some of the stuff on that. Gillette had an awful lot to do with the beardlessness of men. Gillette also had a brainstorm that cost the company a little money in the beginning, but made them a ton of money later. He donated millions of razors to be put into kits for U.S. soldiers overseas. And when they got home, they discovered they all had these wonderful Gillette razors that nobody else's blades would fit easy.
Just one suggestion about the image of Jesus here. I think he should have had a haircut too. You know, I think that would have made it even more interesting. Yeah. My comment is directed to you, and that is just follow this sort of syllogism, which is that the leaders of the church are inspired. They've asked us not to wear beards. If you wear a beard, you're disobedient, and disobedient is immoral.
Well, I would have to say that there are probably degrees of disobedience. I think being disobedient about some things is more critical than others. And I don't know that the church leaders in the last 20 or 30 years have been as vocal. More recently than that. You know, 60s and 70s, I think there was definitely more of a push to, you know, for everyone to conform to clean shaven as of the way of distinguishing Mormons from what was going on in the rest of the world. You know, the Indian world is not up in the world. One way you can demonstrate that is by your appearance. I think more recently, though, we're on to other jots and tittles, like multiple ear piercings and tattoos, which again, I think you can use the same syllogism, follow the same syllogism for either of those items. But I don't think that a beard or multiple ear piercings or tattoos in and of themselves have any kind of inherent immorality to them. I think it's something that we've been told to avoid, but at the same time, I don't know of anyone who's been thrown out of the calling for having a tattoo or multiple ear piercings. I have heard that in some letters to the editor in the BYU newspaper Daily Universe, you know, some men saying, well, I wouldn't date someone who's had more than one ear piercing because they are being disobedient. That's wrong. The prophet has spoken.
How do you find those?
I'll see if I can point you at some of those. But there are some people who will always take that as more than a suggestion and turn it into a commandment, which I don't necessarily think it is. I think it's, you know, and some of these things perhaps are a very strong suggestion. But I like to think that we still have the agency to embrace forms of personal expression, to wear what we want, to have ink on our bodies or multiple holes in our earlobes, regardless. If that's the litmus test, then I fail miserably on two out of three. You know, I don't know if I said probably didn't answer the question.
If I can add a little bit to that, I am in the very sad situation of giving this presentation at the same hour that one that I really like to attend it. And that's one in another room by Glenn Cornett on the problems with the obedience culture that we see coming into the church. Basically, we are trained to obey regardless of the consequences, regardless of whether we are thinking. And his paper, which I plan to get for us at home to listen to, talks about the problems of that. I guess one story I heard maybe illustrates the rest of my own feelings about that. There was a high counselor who got up to speak in church and started talking about things. He got more and more specific as he went along. He finally gave his opinion that deacons should not pass the sacrament unless they had my church in Zion. And that with the young women who had more than one ear pierced, they're not righteous enough to be in the church, and so on. After he got done, the state president got up and said, "We all enjoyed Brother So-and-so's talk." However, he stopped preaching and started meddling about 10 minutes before the end.
I have two small questions. One is, I had an institute director that had us memorize the prior occupations of the current 12 apostles and First Presidency. And I don't know if I remember correctly, but wasn't Elder Hales former CEO of Gillette at one point? I might. Someone could correct me if I'm wrong. But and then my other question is, was John Taylor's neck beard ever popular for anyone else ever?
Actually, I don't know about John Taylor. You might be thinking of Martin Harris with his little electric.
No, John Taylor shaved down.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he did.
Down his job, yeah.
Actually, I found in the Wikipedia article on beards, I found a list of beard styles that people have used over the centuries. I didn't put it on because I didn't want to have too many slides. But yes, that is apparently a recognized style. Martin Harris's little collar beard is one. There are all kinds of, incidentally, you know where the word sideburns came from? General Burnside, who wore big, long, bushy sideburns, and they called them sideburns because of General Burnside. As far as I know, people have occasionally worn that kind of beard. Personally, I can't grow one because my beard hair does not grow in that direction. Any other?
Yeah. I was going to make a couple more anecdotal comments about the BYU Honor Code. To obtain a beer card, I believe you have to get a physician to say that your skin complexion is so bad you have to wear it. But then the funny thing I see is that once you actually get a beard card, you can't not have a beard when you have the beard card, which is really funny. But the second thing I was going to say is that the BYU Honor Code allows for the neatly trimmed beard, which is abhorrent to many girls in my generation. And so the only men that wear them, for the most part, at BYU are doing it to be ironic because it's supposed to be funny, which is I thought was quite interesting.
Mustaches.
Oh, what did I say?
You said beard.
Oh, I meant mustaches.
Yeah,
beard
cannot be grown.
Neatly trimmed mustaches is what I meant. Yeah, but then I had a real quick question. When you read the history on President Wilkinson's involvement in making the dressing grooming standard part of the honor code, it appears to me that it wouldn't have happened if he hadn't have been so indefatigable in his efforts. So I wonder.
I really don't know. He certainly had a lot to do with the church's policy on beer. If you look at the parallel time in the community of Christ, they just kind of went through the whole thing and nobody minded at all. It didn't make any difference. So this is one case where you can probably argue that the presence of one man in that position at that time made a tremendous difference. And we're still all kind of affected by that.
A few years ago, probably 3 or 4 years ago, there was a front page article on beards in the Wall Street Journal that was written and based on some sociological research in terms of opinions of the general population about beards. And the upshot of the article was that beards at that time, and I sense that it's changing a bit, that beards at that time were viewed with suspicion. people who wore beards that were hiding behind something, except in one field, and that is in the artsy creative field, you know, in advertising or artists, and then it's imperative that you wear a beard or long hair. But if you're aspiring in the marketing department to become the vice president, even in engineering at that time, beards were okay for the rank and file, but not for management. And this was based on a number of surveys conducted among the Fortune 500 and other companies. And would you comment on that, please?
I think that's really changing. As you know, sociological studies are quite limited as to time and place. And that one is typical of the lot. We're in a state of flux with respect to beards. Beards have moved out of the arts, out of Hollywood. It's becoming more and more common that beards don't make any difference at all. I guess one of the things that has really made quite a difference is the show Miami Vice. Remember Don Johnson or whatever the guy's name was? Well, I'd always go around looking like he hadn't shaved in 3 or 4 days, and that was very trendy for a while. That was widely disliked in corporate America, but all of a sudden it made a little more neatly trimmed beard look really good by comparison. So I don't know what the status is right now, but I do know it's becoming more and more common, even for upper echelon executives to be bearded. Again, it's a societal thing. Many of the executives who are now retiring got their idea of what looks good as a reaction to 60s counterculture. They didn't want to look like a hippie. Well, that's long enough ago that a lot of the people who are becoming executives now weren't even alive during the 60s. And so it doesn't matter to them. It has no meaning for them.
All right. Just wanted to say that there is a possibility that if beards go through these 50-year cycles of being respectable and not respectable, then perhaps the church leadership isn't 30 years behind the time, but merely 20 years inspired. I was wondering if you could speculate briefly, since we are out of time, on what it is about Mormon culture and religion, religious culture in general, that lets trivialities like this expand into worthiness issues.
That was easy. Trivia are always easier to deal with than things that are deep and profound. We always, it's a human trait. You deal with what's easy. And it's easy to concentrate on the surface and the insubstantial or the easy, rather than spending the work to dig down to the profound.
I don't. It's easier to judge the face than the heart.
Yeah. Fred Boros up here says it's far easier to judge the face than the heart. Fortunately, as the scriptures say, the Lord looketh not on the face, but on the heart. So, fortunately, the only guy who really, in the end, has to judge us doesn't look on the face, he looks on the inside. So whether my thesis about beards being just a societal thing is right or wrong, in the end, the Lord's going to look at something that's far more important than how close I trim my beard, or indeed whether I trim it at all. He's going to look at not the cut of my beard, but the cut of my heart. Thanks.
You may not wear a beard if you're a worker in the Oakland Temple, and you may not wear a beard in the state in the bishopric.
I think that's
so. I can understand where maybe the state that's just directed by.